This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. While serving on his next ship, the concrete-built SS Armand Considere, Len travelled to the war-devastated regions of the Philippines, then on to Japan, where they were moored close by the USS Missouri to witness the Japanese surrender. We take up Len's story in Tokyo at the Japanese surrender. Len's chatting with my colleague Helen Meyer.
Len had taken an unofficially sanctioned trip ashore from where the SS Armand Considere was moored and caught a train into Tokyo itself. On his return to the ship, the captain called him in.
He called me up and he said, "Where have you been?" I said, "I just went to walk around over on the coast." And he said, "You got back, they didn't put a knife in you and didn't hurt you anyway?" I said, "They didn't even look at me. Didn't even speak to me, didn't want to know me." I said, "If I looked at them, I looked away." And he said, "Well," he said, "that's good, you know." I didn't tell him for a while. And then after a while, I thought, "Oh, well, I'll tell him." I caught a train. I took a quick trip into Tokyo on the train and back. And that's when he looked at me. "Oh," he said, "you better not say anything. I should have to report you, you know, the head office over that." He said, "They'd almost court-martial you for that." He said, "We were told not to let anyone go ashore until they surrender sign." He said, "That won't be for another couple of days at least before they all get here." And I said, "Oh," and I said, "don't worry about it." I said, "I won't tell anyone if you don't." And he let me go. He said, "But, oh," he said, "don't go ashore again." I said, "I've no intention to. I've been ashore." So that's how it started. But then after it was signed, after a matter of 3 or 4 or 5 days, the treaty was signed. I can show you the picture of them all coming down, coming ashore, coming onto the Missouri to sign it. All the top brass. We could see them going onto the Missouri to sign. After a while, the skipper called me up and he said, "You're eligible for repatriation. Words come through to repatriate you." He said, "But we would like you to stay on the ship because the ship was going to be handed over to UNRWA and it's going to China." I said, "Well, for the start, so what do you mean UNRWA?" He said, "That's United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation."
UNRWA, or the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, was an international relief agency, largely dominated by the United States, but representing 44 nations. It was founded in 1943 and became part of the UN in 1945. Its purpose was to plan, coordinate, administer, or arrange for the administration of measures for the relief of victims of war in any area under the control of any of the United Nations through the provision of food, fuel, clothing, shelter and other basic necessities, or medical and other essential services. The Armand Considere, on which Len MacLeod was serving, was of course a supply ship.
It's been handed over to United Nations and they will sign you up. I don't think they could have found another fireman to take me place, or it was going to be very hard. And he said, "Well, you stay with us. Come to Shanghai. Think about it for a while. Or," he said, "you can pack your bag and get ready to leave. And I'll fly out to Manila and back to Australia." He said, "That's the only way we can get you back via Manila." I thought about it for a while and I thought, "Oh, well, while the war's over, everything's all right. I'll go." So I stayed with the ship. We pack up and we go into China. When I got to Shanghai, as I told you, I've seen every battlefield all the way, right through from Port Moresby, Milne Bay, around the top of New Guinea, up to the Philippines, and right into Tokyo. But when I got to Shanghai, it affected me worse than anything I'd seen. The starvation, the death, and destruction had a more effect on me than how it was. There was nothing intact. Every morning they go around the streets with a big, like a hay cart, big steel wheels, which we'd have on a farm, and we'd have a couple of horses in it. But they didn't have horses, they'd have a half a dozen Chinese pulling it, and four or five or half a dozen pushing it. And that was only one. They'd go around every street in Shanghai. Every street in Shanghai, they'd have one of these things go around it. And they didn't have tarpaulins. They had bags sewn together as a tarpaulin and pick up the bodies. I see the thing at 9 o'clock in the morning when I went, if I walked ashore. I see it at midday. It might be 4 foot high. All the bodies crossways on it, men, women and kiddies, stacked. Until I seen it a bit later, I couldn't put any more bodies on the top. And they'd put this bag tarpaulin over it, all these bags sounding. They'd put that over the top of them and hang the bag over and take it away and unload it and then come back for more. Thousands of people. I can understand how the Chinese must have felt, you know. It was just terrible. And just recently, I've seen just only a month ago, or less than a month ago, I've seen the show on the ABC, show in Shanghai. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. The roadworks, how it's grown up, and what it looked like. And I said to my daughter and son-in-law, I said, I'd like to see that now. It bugs me up, even thinking about it. I said, I'd like to see it. So they made arrangements, and we're going on the 23rd of this month. I've already booked on it, and we're going over there to have a look. It'll probably put what I've seen to rest. But that hurt me more than seeing what was caused by warfare. There it was caused by nothing but starvation, of how they starved them, and how they treated the Chinese, you know. Little girls and women. Some of them would come up to me. We'd give them everything we had on the ship. Everything we could do, we done. And after about 6 or 7 weeks there, it got to me too much. And I said, you better make an application to get me back to Australia. The captain thanked me for staying with him. On the two occasions, going into the Tokyo with him, all other Australians, all other small ship personnel were only allowed to go to as far as the Philippines. And the Australian government withcalled all personnel back. But somehow I know of one or two others, the same as me, that got to one of my friends. He got to Tokyo. He was in Tokyo, not on my ship, but another ship. He was in Tokyo, and maybe one or two others. But all others from the small ships, which amounted to approximately 3,000, 3 or 400, were all repatriated back to Australia. But they come up to me, the same captain on the Armand Concertier, come up to me, and he said, I told you earlier on, was in the Manila, and he said, by rights, he said, you should be repatriated. But he said, what we will do, we will sign you over to the United States Army, ATS, that was the Army Transport Service, which come directly under the American Army. He said, we'll sign you over to the ATS, and you could stay on as the fireman. Or you could take repatriation. And I said, well, I'll stay on. And that's how we went into eventually ended up in Japan. And the same captain, when he said, you're eligible for repatriation, but we would like you to stay on and go to China. And I said, I'll go to China with you. After a couple of hours thinking about it, I said, all right, I'll sign up. But whether I signed anything, I can't remember ever signing an official contract. I don't know. And to tell you that when I left Australia, we were only going to New Guinea. I didn't have a passport. All I had that they finally come up with me, somewhere up the island somewhere, they come up with a document of identity stating that I was an Australian. And if I was captured, I was to be treated as a civil employee of the United States War Department. Whether the Japanese would have paid much attention to it or not, I don't know. But that is as far as I was up to China, you know.
Lynn, it's an incredible story, and thank you so much for sharing it with us. You've had me in tears here. After those tumultuous times that you lived through, Lynn, I hear that when you returned to Victoria, you actually poured the cast for the Eternal Flame at the Shrine of Remembrance in Melbourne, which seems so fitting. How did that come about?
Well, as I told you earlier, my brother was a credentialed moulder. He was kept in reserved occupation and moulded hand grenades, mainly hand grenades or small bombs that they could put on the road for blowing up vehicles, you know, but mainly hand grenades. He must have made tens of thousands of cast iron hand grenades, which they used to take from Metters in Gordon Street, Footscray, up to the munition factory, which was only about 2 miles up the road in Gordon Street. There was a munition factory, but they only made 303s. Rifle bullets. But up the road, they used to fill these hand grenades with the cordite and the explosives and necessary. Now, after the war, they went back making stoves and such like, you know, in moulding gas stoves and all the castings. While they were there, Benners, my brother, moulded the mould for the Eternal Flame, and I helped him. They knew me in Metters, and I knew the foreman, and I went along with them when they were pouring. We had to pour it, about half a dozen with the ladles full, and manufactured it. And that was polished up and taken where it is situated there now, the Eternal Flame.
Lynn's Eternal Flame was lit at the Shrine of Remembrance in Melbourne by the Queen in 1954. It commemorates the dead of the Second World War, symbolising sacrifice and the perpetuity of remembrance.
I helped put that together. See, after the war, when I come back, I was going to go back with the foundry, and they would have accepted me there, you know. There was a foreman there by the name of Sandy MacLeod, also of the same name, very broad Scotchman. He'd have an MAC, and he always criticised me for not putting the A in. We put just an MC, LEOD, and Sandy, which was the foreman there, he was an MAC, and he always criticised me for not spelling their name right.
Lynn, how old were you when you eventually left Shanghai and returned to Australia?
I would have been, by the time I got home, would have been about 7 or 8 months after the war had finished. I would have been around about the 19-year-old by the time I got back.
What year were you born?
I was born on the 2nd of the 6th, 26. 26-26, very easy to remember. Some very important people born in 1926. The Queen's mother, 26 obviously was a good year. But It was a very frightening year. To give you an idea, when we only had a population barely 5 million people in the whole of Australia, and they were talking about giving half Australia away where we could fight the Japanese in the open. Terrible. So everyone was horrified. You could see almost tears in their eyes, expecting any minute to be notified that the Japanese had landed, either in Western Australia or somewhere on the East Coast. They were all terrified. And that stirred me up too, because as a young fella, as I was growing up, my mother told me all about the First World War, and that was going to be the end, the war to end all wars, the First World War. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, that shattered. It wasn't so bad in 1939 when they were fighting in the Middle East, but when the Japs come in, I knew, as I grew up, that the Japanese Navy escorted my father in the First World War. They didn't come into it, but their Navy escorted our troop ships to the Middle East. There's not many people know that, I don't think. But they were on our side in 1948, well, up to a point. And then all of a sudden, they bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, you know the story of that, the terrible atrocities that took place there. Sure. How could they do it? This is just a little bit of a story. When I was growing up, there used to be a group of us on the street corner. We never caused any trouble. We never went up, broke into people's houses. We never smashed people's cars, windows. We did no damage to anyone. About eight of us on the street corner, and I was the youngest one. But see, being tall, I was always accepted. I could always sit in, and I could find out what was going on. It was mainly talking about football and such like, or cricket. But the story came out this way, that one of the chaps said, we ought to ring up the local policeman. We all knew the local policeman, because he made a point of coming around schools and everywhere. A constable by the name O'Donnell. He lived in Ballarat Road. Now, everyone knew him. We lived in Footscray in those days. We got the eldest one, which would have been Charlie Newson, to get on the phone and ring up Constable O'Donnell to come up and shift the larrikins, hooligans, and the troublemakers and so-and-so off the street corner because they're making a nuisance of themselves. He had the eldest voice. So Constable O'Donnell, very broad Irish, not very tall, thick set. Another constable lived further away, a Constable Glinter. They were pretty clever policemen in those days. They come up on their bikes at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night, dark. We're waiting for them, see? Well, in those days, we could disperse down that passageway, across the park here, over there through vacant allotments, and disappear when we knew they were coming. How we knew they were coming, they were very clever. They used to come up on police bicycle in those days, a big heavy bicycle, and it had a generator on the front wheel. On the top of the bike, they had a headlight, big headlight that they could switch on and switch off, which they did. They switched the light off as they got near Prince Street and Mitchell Street in North Footscray. And as I were getting 200 or 300 yards away, we were listening. We could hear the generators on the two bikes buzzing away, but no light. So we disperse. But see, being very clever constables, they woke up that we heard. So they didn't come the next night or the next night. I think I left for two nights. And then all of a sudden, around the corner, on foot, they come and push four of us up against the picket fence. And guess who? I was one of them. He lines us up, four of us. The others disappear. I think I could have outraced the whole lot of them, but I got caught. I was too late. But he's given us a big lecture that went a lot of hooligans, creating a nuisance, and so on. It goes on about hooligans and nuisance and blah, blah, blah. And he comes to the first fellow. He said, "What's your name?" He said, "Charlie." "So Charlie who?" And he said, "Charlie," and he's nervous. He said, "Charlie Newson, N-E-W-S-O-N. But he thought it was Newson. And hit him over the head with his baton. Bang! Over his bloody head and a big bump, about half the size of an egg, on the top of his head. And he's telling him the truth. His name was Charlie Newson. And Charlie's hanging onto his head, and bloody, you know, half crying. And he gets to the next fella, and he said, "What's your name?" He said, "Jimmy Houlihan." He's a bit nervous too. And his name was Houlihan. But this Irishman thought he meant hooligan.
Oh, no.
So what happens? He gets his head over the bloody head. Bang! And he's nursing a bloody big lump on his head. And I tell you, those batons in those days were not little bloody batons. Mm. Anyhow, he comes to the next fella. And I'm trembling in my shoes. I've got one to gum. He comes to this fella and he said, "What's your name?" He said, "By the way, this is the fella who shot me later on, but was in come from Western Australia in the army." He said, "What's your name?" He said, "My name's Billy." "Billy who?" "Billy Bird." And he didn't get hit over the head. I wondered why. That was strange. Didn't get hit over the head. And he said, "And where do you live?" He said, "Number 5, Emu Street." And the copper hit him over the head. He said, "Just because my name's Buddy Steele," he said, "I don't have to live in Iron Street." And hit him again.
Oh, Bird, Emu. Yes, right, okay.
He thought he was taking the pill out of him, telling him, you know, he did live in Emu Street. He was telling him the truth. Mm. They were all telling him the truth. And the three of them got hit over the head. Now, on next, and I tell you what, that learnt me to think quickly. And I think I started thinking quickly when I was in the army and the small ships. I had to think quickly. And he said to me, he said, "And what's your name?" Now, I knew they got hit over the head because they said their name. And this fellow got hit over the head because he said, "Emu Street." They all told the truth. And he said to me, he said, "What's your name?" I said, "Lenny McLeod." I didn't get hit over the head. And he said, "Where do you live?" Now, I remembered when he said his name, he got hit over the head. I said, "Just over there." And I pointed my finger at the house. And do you know, I was the only one that never got hit over the head. But getting back to telling you about how it was, those three fellas all ended up in the army, and one of them got away, he died as a prisoner of war. He was captured in Singapore. Singapore fell and died. One of our boys. Everyone ended up in the army. That's how it was in those days. But I thought that is because it was telling the truth and it was comical.
The American Small Ships Reunion is going to be held in Sydney at the Grace Hotel in May this year. Are you going?
Well, we went on the 20th of May last year. What happened? When I come home and I told different people where I was and my two girls were growing up, and they'd go to school and talk about what their father did, and they would tell others, and other people would doubt it because they hadn't heard of it or knew much about it. I found the same thing with it. So I didn't talk to anyone about it, you know. As I grew up, I shut up about it because we're no good talking about it. But just a little bit before May, early last year, Denise, my youngest daughter, I seen a little piece in the local paper up here in Queensland, because if anyone in Queensland knew of anyone that was in these American small ships, or their fathers or relatives were, please ring such and such a telephone number. So what has she done? She knew all about it. She knew that I was there. So she rang that telephone number and spoke to the secretary in Sydney. The secretary in Sydney, within sight of a matter of days, jumps on the plane, comes up to Queensland, and I'm in an old folks' home with my wife. My wife was in a bad way. She'd lost the use of both arms. She was in a bad way. She couldn't put her glasses on. She couldn't clean her teeth. She couldn't feed herself. And we had a nice place, so we decided we'd sell that. And we ended up going into a retirement village at Deception Bay. So he jumps on the plane, comes up, and arrives at Deception Bay where we were. 10 o'clock in the morning, one of the nurses come up and said, I've got someone here to see you. Well, I sent him in. I said, yeah, send him in. He come in and sat down, and he had a mobile, so I thought, in his top pocket, which I could see. But he sat down, he said, I'd like to ask you some questions, Landon. He said, you were in the United States small ships. I said, yeah. And he started to ask me where I joined and where I went, and I told him, you know, which I've told you, from up to Port Moresby, all around New Guinea, up to Leyte, Philippines. And I said I ended up in Japan and so on. So he's asking all these questions. I said I can answer them as honestly as I can and as I remember them. About 2 hours asking me these questions. And then they started to get us ready, the wife and I, ready for midday lunch. And he said, do you mind if I come back after lunch? I said, no. So he came back after lunch, an hour or so later. He sat down, and I thought, well, this is strange. He's asking all these questions. He hadn't struck one, but had done the whole lot, you know. After about an hour, hour and a half or so after lunch, and away he went. About a week later, he sends back a great heap of book pages, all typed out. And he said, I want you to read these carefully. Anything you think needs changing or is not right, let me know. So I read it through very, very carefully a couple of times. He said, if it's true and correct, let me know. So I rang him up. I said, well, look, that's dead accurate, as accurate as I remember it, as honest as I could. That was the start. Well, then about a month later, I get an invitation to go down to Sydney, down to the big hotel in Sydney.
Len's referring to the Grace Hotel in Sydney. It was the headquarters of the US Army small ships during World War II.
And do you know, you would not credit this, it was 75 years, almost to the day, that I walked through the same door in that hotel where General MacArthur had been taken over that place. And as I walked through, they had a nice big plaque on the wall. It explained everything. You know, I thought, 75 years ago, goodness gracious. But that's true as anything. It was the same hotel that MacArthur had. Oh, it's all been done up and it's all a beautiful hotel. But when I get there, the American consul comes up and shakes me hand, and the New Guinea consul come up. Now, I've got to tell you something about the New Guinea consul. It struck me as funny. The New Guinea consul said, oh, he said, I've read your report, he said, and you were in numerous places in New Guinea. He said, could you name a few? Well, I named them just like I named them to you, around New Guinea, right around the North Coast, up the North Coast, and all the whole lot, over in Wau, Central New Guinea. I dropped supplies in every one of those places where they needed troops and where we had spotters. We used to have spotters on different parts of the coast, and we'd supply them with food every now and again. We'd fly over and drop them food. I only ever dropped food. I didn't ever use a parachute once. We used to just kick it straight out of the plane, great big heap, straight out. All in boxes or all in tins. The tins would be in bags or the boxes would be in great big sacks. So when it hit the ground, it would tend to all stay together. Might bust open a few tins and things like flatten a few tins. But getting back to the New Guinea consul, when I'd finished telling him that, he said, "Do you know something, Len?" He said, "You know more about my country than I do myself." That was the consul telling me that I'd seen more of his country than he'd seen himself. But then the American consul, I pinned a few more medals on me, and he said, "You've got more medals to come." He said, "You've got the occupation of," he pinned the Merchant Service Medal and some other service medal on me. I've got them there. I've got my own. Not that I believe in medals, but my grandchildren might like them after I've gone, you know. My daughter will pass them on. And he said, "There's several more to come." Oh, yeah, there's the occupation of Japan and the Leyte campaign and the Manila campaign. There's three more medals or something. Trump has been too busy with other things, you know, and he may get around half of them there, I think, by the 18th of next month when we're there. There was several hundred well-dressed people that had relatives, either some of them had their husbands, you know, elderly women about my age there, where husbands passed on, were in the small ships, and the only thing they could find was four of us. And I was by far the most fit and able body of the other three. I have found out since that at least two of them have packed in, so there could only be one left, and myself, if he's still alive. In America, they look on it as a big deal, you know.
It is a big deal, Len. Len, just getting back to one thing that you mentioned, you talked about photos. Did you take your own photos? Have you got photos that you personally took during that time, or are they all official photos?
We weren't allowed. It was illegal to carry a camera in case we were captured. They wouldn't let us have a camera. I got a photo taken when I was in the Philippines, and that's about the only... Oh, a couple on a ship. I got one on the Armand Considia. I was with one of the deck boys. And got a couple of snaps, but I would have liked, and what I should have done, thinking back, if I could have only put the dates down, the dates we'd joined these ships would have been nice, you know.
You've done exceptionally well at any rate, Len, to remember all this and get it down.
Not that I want to hear it, but the kids know it's genuine, Len.
You deserve for the people of Australia to hear your story, Len. You deserve it.
Why I'm interested in it is not so much for myself, but there were 3,400 other people and an awful lot of them. Do you know they weren't entitled to anything in the way of a pension? They weren't recognised by the DVA. The DVA recognised me because I was in New Guinea and I dropped supplies all over New Guinea. They know that. I was a volunteer when they were first dropping. We would go out. I never told you the full story. The nine planes would go out, would take off at Port Moresby, when they got an all clear, when they knew there was no Japanese approaching because we had observation points miles around, hundreds of miles around. Nine of us would take off and we'd go up into a formation of three. They'd be three, what we term, 347s. They were DC-3s in Australian terms, or C-47s in American terms. And nine of them, they just got nine in. And that's where they wanted 18 men to drop when we volunteered, the first 18. So then the 18 of us were always together. They'd have two army personnel and the radio operator in the DC-3. One would stand at the door. The doors were left on the ground, the two doors, and a big open gap of about 8 feet wide with these two doors. They throw them on the ground and we take off without the doors and then we'd stack them. But I was the tallest and I took up the position on the floor where I put my feet out and skid out a whole load. Each plane would carry approximately 2.5 ton, which you can't drop all of those together. And you had to go up between the wings. They were all stacked boxes and tins and take them down and stack them there. And then a radio operator on the plane, the two pilots, they were pretty smart. They'd have an Australian pilot, an American co-pilot, or vice versa. There was always an Australian-American flying the plane. And they had a radio operator, which sometimes Australian, sometimes American. But they used to stack up maybe several hundredweight. It used to take anywhere between 5 and 8 drops. They'd come down one behind the other, if we were all dropping together, one behind the other about a kilometre apart, to treetop level, and then zoom up when we kicked it out. And then they'd go around and we'd stack up another load until the 2.5 ton. Pilot would say, get as much as you can out. I don't have to go down for another run. If we got it out in 5 lots, I was happy as anything because they'd just circle around and wait for the others. They might take 6 or 7 runs down and we'd wait for them to come up. And then we'd join up as 3 and then 3 behind and 3 behind that. But we were always escorted by so many fighter planes. I used to go into the control centre, pencilled on the board, 5 or 6 fighter planes would be around us, somewhere around us. Sometimes we'd see them close, sometimes they'd be further away. A couple of times we were on our way to drop supplies. We'd turn round, we'd come back over. And I looked out, and I looked down there, we're back in Port Moresby, we dropped nothing. So when we got on the ground, I said, what's the trouble? They said, well, oh, those Japs were bombing where we were going to drop in that vicinity. So we didn't want to be mixed up with them. So we come back and waited 4 or 5 hours before we went out again.
Were your fighter escort from the RAAF or were they Americans?
Americans.
All Americans, right.
Well, as far as I know, could have been a combination, I think. Flying the C-47s, or the DC-3s, whichever you like, they had an American pilot, but I think an Australian pilot with them, because I think the Australian pilots knew the area better, you know what I mean? Some of them had flown over New Guinea more, whereas the American was at a loss for a while until he'd done it a while, you know. That's why I think I had the Australian and the American pilot and co-pilot. In the fighter planes, I would say they were all American simply because I don't think there was too many Australians that could have flown them. Our fighter planes in those days, you know the story, if they were up there, they took off to land. I forget the name of it, but it was useless, totally useless. The Wirrawai.
Oh,
the Wirrawai.
Oh, goodness
me. Yeah, the old Wirrawai. That was our fighter plane when war broke out. It was useless. England was too busy over there with the Germans, see? Sure. And they wouldn't let any more than the 5th, 6th and 7th Battalion come home.
That C-47 was also affectionately known as the Biscuit Bomber. Why was it called a Biscuit Bomber?
Well, I think that was the only task it could do.
Right, drop in supplies.
Yes. Mm. As far as I'm concerned, and we sometimes done two trips in a day before the weather cut up in the tropics up there, the weather can change in an hour. But usually in the morning, it'd be nice and clear and all right for 3 or 4 hours, and we'd get a drop in. Many times, the weather would be against us, you know. I spoke to one of the chaps in our flight when 9 of us took off on this particular day when I lost my 2 mates, which I'd been with for quite some time. When we were dropping above the door, there was a red and a green light. We were lectured that when the green light comes on, kick it all out as quick as you can. But soon as the red light goes on, stop. Even don't kick anything more out. Now, whether they kicked it out or whether it got caught somewhere, what happened, the one was crashed. I found this from an eyewitness on the army. We were dropping supplies to him. And just by a coincidence, in Port Moresby, I was in a group of fellas and he was telling the story about the biscuit bomber crashing. So I walked in. So I listened. And I let him finish and I said, when was this and so on and where? And I forget the name of the native village we were dropping at now. I said, I was on one of those flights. I dropped maybe the one before that. When we dropped, we'd go up and you wouldn't see the other one behind you. When you got up and you circled at the top and looked back, we were in a position I could have seen it crash, but we weren't in the same position. So I didn't actually witness it crash, but we're in the same circle. He explained to me, yeah, they were dropping down to us. And he said, what happened? You know what happened, Len? I said, no, no idea. He said, what happened? See, they'd put 2 4-gallon drums of biscuits. They'd dropped a lot of biscuits and a lot of bully beef. You know the bully beef tins, little tins. What happened? The biscuits, 2 in a bag, but they were light. See, the biscuits were not light. And they blew back. It must have been on the rise because it's all mountainous country. They come down the valley and then they've got to turn to get out of the valley. And as he turned to go up, the biscuits must have flown back and got in between the elevator and the rudder, the plane. Now, if the pilot would have known that, and he could have flicked the rudder a little bit, or the elevator up or down, it would have run away. But he had to turn in the mountain, and no way did he want to alter that, and the plane just plowed straight over and down. Killed the 5 soldiers, the 2 droppers, the radio operator and the co-pilot and the pilot. And he told me all about it. And I said to him, did you let him know, you know? He said, I went and let them know, but he said, whether they took notice. He said, I could see the thing jammed in the tail because he was on the ground and it was only just 20 feet above the trees, you know, just above the top of the tree. He witnessed it.
It's a sad story. Sad story repeated too many times in wartime. I'm going to look forward to seeing you in Sydney in May. And
okay.
I'm looking forward to hearing how you went with Shanghai, because at that stage you would have been and come back.
Well, I'm a little bit surprised already with what I've seen on the ABC show there. I think myself, our politicians, it wouldn't hurt them to go and see it too. I think what I've just seen, the roadwork and the buildings, and I'll be very interested, because bear in mind, as bad as you could see it or anyone else could see it, I would put it not 10 times, it was hundreds of times worse than the average person could see it. Hell, the starvation, death and destruction from civilian people, just ordinary men, women and little kids, you know, dying of starvation.